You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Good morning. I'm Meg Riley. Today I'm in Santa Monica, California, and you've joined us for another episode of The View. We have a special guest today, as we always do, Julica Herman de la Fuente. I wanted to mention that we had advertised to get you to watch that we'd have the two presidential candidates. Actually, that didn't pan out for this week. So they will be here March 31st. Today we're going to have an exciting conversation about beloved conversations with Julica. Well, I've been passionate about this subject of conversations ever since I ran the GLBT office in 1992. I feel like so many of the ways that we talk to each other aren't helpful and amount to getting down in our bunkers further. And in fact, there's research that some kinds of conversations actually cause retrenchment on people's part. And certainly within the UUA, we've seen some of that. And so I'm really interested in what actually moves people towards transformation. And so Mark Hicks and Meadville Lombard and the FOS Collaborative, as I understand it, Julica's going to tell me if I just made a huge faux pas by linking those three things with this program called Beloved Conversations that's been going on for a while. And Julica's been the learning coordinator there for the last couple of years. So Julica, would you just start by telling us the origin of it, and did I get that right? Is it part of the FOS Collaborative? And just tell us about the Beloved Conversations program.
For sure. Yeah, you did get it right, Meg. Thank you for framing it that way. The FOS Collaborative is a part of Meadville Lombard, and Mark Hicks is the director of the FOS Collaborative. And as I understand it, the program started when...
pausing a moment and just saying who FOS is and what the FOS Collaborative is, because we just used insider talk, and I've been told we alienate people by using insider talk. So
thank you, Meg.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so the FOS Collaborative is a laboratory for religious education within Meadville. So the FOS, what we do in the FOS Collaborative is all kinds of experiments and programs and exploring what works in good religious education. It's named after Sophia FOS because she was such a visionary in our movement. So the Beloved Conversations program is one of several things that the FOS Collaborative does. And it started when Bill Sinkford was called to Portland after he served as president of the UUA. And he arrived there and he said, oh, we need to have conversations about race. And I mean, I'm sure that it wasn't quite like this, but the story that I've learned and that I tell is that he called Mark up and he said, Mark, make me a thing. We need to talk about race here in Portland.
And well, the Mark, reason why, if I can jump in, Julica, is because that's what all the white people in the congregation kept wanting him to talk about race. Hi, Julica. That's how Bill said it. Is he, you know, I heard it from Bill, but people kept, he was there to be their minister, the largest congregation on the West Coast, I believe, or one of, and everyone, instead of just being their minister, they wanted him to be the point person on race, and so hence the phone call to Mark.
There we go. Thank you, Aisha. I appreciate that. Yes. So then Mark made a thing, and the thing he made was Beloved Conversations. And now we have 58 congregations across the country in the Beloved Conversations Network, which is just super exciting. It's just
so when
great.
He made a thing, what did he make?
So he made this curriculum, and it is a 8-session program. Each session is 2 hours. And it's a pretty strongly crafted and guided curriculum with some notes for the facilitators of specific exercises, specific things to do in order to move folks in an arc as we learn how to have these conversations that we don't usually have. And before you do the 8 sessions, the beginning of the program starts with a day and a half retreat. And the day and a half retreat is like the launching point. Because, you know, anytime you do a small group program, it takes people some time to warm up to each other and to actually build trust. So the retreat kind of takes care of that. People get to the first session and they are ready to talk.
And so the retreat is for the participants.
It's for everybody, for the participants and the facilitators who will then be taking the groups through the conversations. And the conversations, the groups are 8 to 12 people. Often a congregation runs two or three groups at the same time. And sometimes we have some congregations come together and form a cluster.
So
in fact, oh, go ahead.
So I used to be part of the Social Justice Empowerment Program, and there you made sure that the whole staff and the board president, people like that, were there because it was about systemic change. Is this like that, or is it more of a voluntary, kind of class small group thing? Is it about the institution of the church, or is it more about the individuals involved, or both?
I think it's both. And what I encourage folks to do, I'm the first person that people speak to usually when they're interested in Beloved Conversations. So I usually encourage the folks contacting me. They're either lay leaders, social justice, social action committee leaders, or sometimes the ministers themselves. And what I encourage them to do is to be very deliberate in inviting a certain group of people first to participate in this, who are on the board, lay leadership in general, in the church and staff. But it is voluntary, and it's important that it be voluntary, because you can't force these conversations, right? You can't force this process. People need to be in a particular place of wanting to take risks in order for it to work.
Are the groups intentionally designed to be interracial, or are they caucuses, or how do you work that piece?
There aren't caucuses. There is a caucusing portion of the program in session 6. We do break into caucuses. But one of the things I like about this program is it works whether you have an interracial group or an all-white group. Many of our congregations don't have people of color. And I think it's important that we have conversations about race, even in those, especially in those contexts.
Especially, yeah. But what about the – well, maybe this might be a question for later on – but I'm wondering about this dynamic where I think some folks, congregants who are people of color, can be way, way in the minority in their congregation, can feel besieged, and sort of unconscious white people will ask them to represent their entire ethnicity or, you know, do all that crazy stuff. So how do you account for that?
Well, what I like about how this works is that it actually is an invitation to look at how we are talking about race and where we are around issues of race, regardless of whether we're white or a person of the global majority, which is my new favorite way of talking about people of color. So what I know myself as a Mexican woman in a UU church is that I often delay my own needs and set aside what it is that I'm doing in my own spiritual development in order to take care of white folks and to talk about these issues and educate them. And it has been since I have been doing this work with Mark Hicks that I've had this mirror, and I've gone, oh my goodness, I didn't realize that that's what I was doing. And I have heard other people of color report the same thing, that our work is to help people of color and white folks figure out where they are in their own faith development and where the faith development piece intersects with race and other identities, social identities, and what they need to do next in their own process. And that's different, of course. But it's, for me, a completely different frame, completely different from how it used to be when I had diversity conversations before. And this feels a lot more doable and a lot more sustainable.
It's good to hear. I'm curious if you have stories of congregations where this process has changed for them, what has changed for you by doing it, or similar, I mean, I don't mean identically what changed for you, but have you seen changes in congregations that have done this?
Well, actually, I would love to hand that question over to Aisha. That just seems like I should not be talking about East Shore if Aisha's here.
Okay.
East Shore has done Beloved Conversations 5 times over the last 2.5 years. So we offer it in the fall. I know. So what's interesting, I do want to first say, because when Julika, you said it's important that this is voluntary, that is absolutely true. Before our minister left in the spring, he, I'm not going to say forced, because you clearly can't force anyone, but strongly encouraged, just stop short of forcing, one staff member and a couple of board members. And that it was a disaster. It wasn't a disaster. I'm going to take that back. It was a difficult class because of that. And so that's definitely I want to really lift up, like, please have folks who want to do this, do it. So if you're a minister or if you, you know, I do agree with Julika that having staff do it, you know, is great for systemic change. But if the staff doesn't want to do it, all that's going to do is create a difficult paradigm. In fact, one of the white men, in fact, in that group said to one of the facilitators, I love the program, I don't like this group. And it's because the folks who didn't want to do it were just really set on arguing, derailing, like it almost became like their teen, you know, they became teenagers again in some ways. But anyway, I digress. So here's what's interesting that happened in East Shore. When I first got here, and it, Beloved Conversations was offered, I had just started working here. I just moved to the Pacific Northwest, and it was offered about maybe 2 months later. So, and that first class was actually large. It was 19 white people. The only person of color in the room was Rhonda Brown, the co-facilitator with the minister. And it, just from that class, seeds were planted that are continuing. You know, we're seeing crocuses now as to what's happening in this congregation. And we're the lens with which folks who've taken Beloved Conversations use to have conversations about the future of this congregation is where the difference is. I'm certain, I could say with certainty that we wouldn't be where we are now in terms of our social justice work, especially with regards to race, if Beloved Conversations hadn't been so prominent here. And I do have to give credit to Rhonda Brown, who does I think Julika works closely with you and even in other congregations. I credit her for the success of Beloved Conversations here, because I do know other congregations, you know, it hasn't been quite, I think, this successful in every congregation. I know it's done well in most of them, but I credit just Rhonda's an exceptional facilitator from day one, and she still continues to be. So one of the things that's happened here is we have a Beloved Conversation steering committee that's going to become a ministry team, so it'll become more, it'll be one of the teams that are constant here. And what we do is we talk about offering continuing classes and movies. So I, under the Beloved Conversations education team, I showed the movie Dear White People as a multi-generational event. We had pizza. I had questions set up afterwards. And I did have not many youth, but I had a few youth from middle school all the way up to folks elderly. So it was, we had about 30 people show up. So it was great. So it has really offered the place to have the conversations in the class, but when we talk about inclusion, you know, the conversation now has opened up to what do we mean by that? Because, of course, as you use, we say, yeah, we're inclusive. I don't think we fully, you know, it's like the Princess Bride. I don't think that word means what you think it means. yeah, so we've had that. So that's been just really interesting, and in fact, Manny Brown, Rhonda's husband, and a man named Seth Hamilton have been standing on a busy road just a couple blocks away from the church holding Black Lives Matter signs. And folks from the congregation, now it's part of, you know, we invite people to do this with them, and folks stand on the corner, rain or shine. They even had the Seattle Peace Choir come and sing with them one Sunday. And we're getting, the board just voted and approved getting a Black Lives Matter sign on the church grounds. So it's exciting. It's definitely, and it's hard.
Are you saying that Beloved Conversations has kind of become the banner under which all of the racial justice work is being done then, as well as being a specific curriculum? Or, I mean, like the movie night, I'm just trying to get.
Yes. Exactly. So yes, for the past 2.5 years, the banner has been Beloved Conversations. What the conversation now, actually Rhonda and I and the leaders who've taken Beloved Conversations and are most passionate about it are now, we're morphing into, this has to be, you know, the systemic part. Okay, we're moving from Beloved Conversations, we're going to call the ministry team something else, and it will be focused on racial justice. And Rhonda's very good about when folks say, well, what about, you know, we move to classism, or we move to, she said, we're talking about race, you know, and then people want to go left, and she's like, nope, we're coming back here to race, and then they, and so she's really, and I've learned actually from her to do the same things, like, well, we're here, and in fact, Robin DiAngelo, who lives in Seattle, and she coined the phrase white fragility, we've brought her here twice under the racial justice work we've been doing here, so it's been extraordinary, and I'm watching and part of seeing the transformation that can happen in a predominantly white, large, I mean, we're over 500, we're a large church, happen, congregation, and the commitment has to be there. It's not going to just happen and give lip service to it. It's been very difficult for some people.
I actually have a question. I'm really curious. I'm hearing about these transformational powers of this. So, Julka, what is the arc of the curriculum? Is there, I mean, I don't want to spoil the experience for people, but how do you start and what's the...
this isn't a secret sauce kind of thing. It's not like we're not going
to
tell you how it works until you sign up. No, the way... That's a great question, Bob. I appreciate it. The way that it works is we go from looking at our own individual patterns, ways of thinking, the places where we may have been not... engaging this in the best way. So the beginning of the curriculum is more focused on the individual and the individual's experience, and then it shifts into congregational. So the congregation becomes the laboratory that you look at to see how so there's a congregational audit, and so you look at this audit and you say, what are we doing and what are we not doing and how could we be doing this differently now that we have an awareness about how race plays for people in their lives. The most powerful exercise that gets reported back in the feedback is actually one on microaggressions that captures the experience of microaggressions. So there's a fair amount of exercises that help people become more aware of racism and that give room for people of color. For me, the experience is like, well, finally, it's on the table. Now it's named. Now we can talk about it. And it's done in a way that there's room to talk about it. And what I like about it is that there isn't a focus on guilt and shame the way that I have experienced in other programs, where if you have privilege, you're bad and wrong. I think rather the focus is, you have privilege, what are you going to do with it? How are you going to leverage it? And how are we doing that in our church? Where are our systems reflecting our unconscious racist biases? So the arc is from the individual to the organizational. But I would say that it's primarily focused on the individual. And I would also, the other thing that I say to people when I explain Beloved Conversations is it's not something that you've done and you check the box. It's something that you continuously do. Any of us who do this work know that this work is lifelong, right? Like the work of fighting racism and fighting any form of oppression is about the small daily choices. And what you need is a space where you can connect to other people that help you see those small daily choices and then make them and have the courage to speak up and say, I've been noticing in our hiring practices, or I've been noticing in our curriculum, I've been noticing this or that. So it's about creating a conversation that continues beyond the 8 sessions. So it's kind of teaching us to have those conversations that are taboo. We're not supposed to talk about this because nice people don't see race. Nice people don't see difference because that makes you bad. And clearly, it's what you were talking about
there
earlier.
There you go. Meg. Bringing up race again. So there you go, bringing up race again.
I know, right? Yes.
I have a funny story that it was, okay, so during the fourth class, Peter Luton, our former minister here, was giving a really powerful sermon about what inclusion means and diversity, and we are an older-leaning congregation, part why they hired me as the DRE is to attract more younger families. I've been on this personal mission to get older folks comfortable with babies in the sanctuary. And, you know, we have plenty of space. We have a huge campus, but that's not the point. You know, the idea is, how do we make families feel welcome? So Peter was giving a sermon about inclusion, and in fact, I think he was talking about families, and he went on and on. And during this sermon, a toddler was making noise. And so an usher, I was not there. The way the story got back to me is the family was informed other places where they can hear the sermon. Well, someone who was sitting near the person immediately after the service went to the board president. I found out within 10 minutes after the service being over that a family was made to feel unwelcome because of this baby. We call it the crying baby incident. And we have a Beloved Conversations listserv, a private one in the church. So immediately emails went out that afternoon. And what I loved about it, and to add to it, it was an African-American family. So just to add to the fun, like, we're a predominantly white congregation. And so it was like, wow, it just was like the perfect scenario. And what was great for me is that that conversation never would have happened before Beloved Conversations at all. It would have been accepted that noisy toddlers are invited to go elsewhere, and nobody would have, no matter what color they were, would have commented on it. But instead, it really created a powerful conversation afterwards. I got involved as, you know, the DRE, and had already taken Beloved Conversations at that point. So when that family visited again, because I had actually met the family not knowing any of this went on, and I had showed them the preschool before the service started, and the little boy did not want to go. I said, oh, you're more than welcome to stay in the service. Because not all the toddlers don't always want to leave their parents. And in fact, during Beloved Conversations, one of our congregants from Bolivia said, you know, when I first visited here, you wanted to take my children away. but afterwards, when they came to visit, maybe a couple weeks later, you know how many, I had five different people run up to me and go, we saw the family, we invited them, we let them stay, we were giving the toys to the child. I mean, it was just one incident of something that wouldn't have happened had these conversations not happened.
I've heard stories in other congregations where the tools that we teach in Beloved Conversations get used in board meetings. That makes me really happy. That just.
What kind of tool would you use in a board meeting?
Well, in this case, what happened was the exercise that we start the retreat with is called the Big Assumption Exercise, that helps us look at the way that we are framing our perspective might be part of the issue, and that we need to shift the assumptions that we're making. And because enough people in the boardroom at that point had the Big Assumptions Exercise, they leveraged that and said, wait, maybe this is a Big Assumptions moment, and we just need to step back and look. And there were enough people in the room that they were able to explain what that meant, and they used it.
Can you explain what it means? Because it sounds like the secret ingredient in the sauce right now to me. What's a big assumption?
Well, okay, so that might be a secret ingredient in the sauce thing. I don't know if I can.
I've done the big assumption, yeah, and I would actually, if people are going to participate in it, and if they know too much going in,
yeah,
I think it might just sort of, it might overthink it.
You gotta do the program to get to know the big assumption. It sounds like, yes, Seinfeld, the big salad.
It's a pretty awesome thing, but I love that. So, what do you find are the big stumbling blocks when people aren't participating? Like, now that you've seen a bunch of different congregations going through, like, what do you see as the places where people get stuck a little bit?
Well, you know how in any system, the anxiety can show up in really funny ways? So I see anxiety around logistics, but I don't think it's really about the logistics. So it's kind of like the copier or the coffee or the napkins or the whatever it is that there's a kerfuffle in our church around, but it's not really about the copier or the coffee or the napkins or whatever it is. I'm thinking about the feedback that I've heard where it doesn't go as well, and I think probably I haven't heard enough of that feedback, Bob, because I don't think people come back to me
And my position is fairly new formally, and so as I've, although Meg, you said that I've been doing it for a couple of years, it was a really slow ramp up. And so it's really been in the past semester that we have really instituted a culture of you need to check in, you need to tell us how it's going. In the past, there were so many congregations interested, and Mark could only do so much, and so there was less of a feedback loop that I think we're building in now. One of the things that we did hear was that there was too much in the curriculum. There were too many challenges, and we changed it. We actually developed the 2.0 version, and we've been running that since September. I'm not sure. Ask me another question, Bob, because I'm not really sure what else to say around that.
No,
I neglected to say that you're a candidate for UU Ministry and a student at Meadville Lombard. And I'm curious how this work that you're doing with Beloved Conversations feeds into your ministerial formation, and if you see ways that you wish it were feeding in more for other people, or if you feel like, I'm just curious how this program is impacting Meadville Lombard, which of course is doing lots of other stuff also about race and racism and whiteness and boundary crossing and all that.
Yeah, the whole boundary crossing is a frame that Meadville uses in their signature courses, and it's very strong. And there's a lot of students saying, hey, when are we going to be doing Beloved Conversations? And hopefully the answer is soon. I'm not really in the challenge in Meadville in particular, and this actually connects to other opportunities for congregations that are remote and can't afford it, or potentially for Church of the Larger Fellowship, is how do you do this online? What is the online version of this work? How can you reach people who are not geographically together for extended periods of time? It's a really juicy question, and one that we have been engaging and will continue to do. To do that, for me personally, working with Mark is that moment of realizing that this is something that I could actually start doing even before I finished the MDiv. What it felt was like grace for me. And this is my ministry and this is my work, and I feel incredibly passionate about it. And like Rhonda, I have a tendency to say we're talking about race. No, let's bring it back to race. Like I'm very committed to anti-racist work, not because I don't see the interconnections and not because I'm not committed to other forms of oppression and ending those as well, but because I feel very passionately that this is a very important moment for us in our society, in this country, and potentially in the world, and we need to leverage it, and we really need to step up the way that we did with marriage equality. I feel a lot of momentum, and I'm very excited about when I hear other seminarians engage with this. It's clearly at the forefront of many of our minds, and it's always in our conversations, and I think that's really important.
I'm curious, with Beloved Conversations, if you have seen any sort of generational differences in both the willingness to get into this, or, you know, how people react to it?
I'm thinking, Joanna, but I'm not immediately thinking of a generational difference that I've noticed. So we ran Beloved Conversations in my home congregation as well, so I'm also drawing from that more personal experience. There were a few people, and I have heard of a few people, who would say, I did a Jubilee training or I did a Journey Towards Wholeness conversation, and I will never talk about race again. Like, I will never engage in a conversation like that again because it was so painful.
Wow, that sounds like
so there were a couple of people. It was really sad. And there were... Go ahead.
Yeah. Just that sounds like some really deep wounds.
Yeah. I think some of us do have some really deep wounds in having conversations about race previously. And that's, I think, why I get kind of evangelical about this one, is because I feel like it is focused on healing. It is focused on the faith formation context. So the exercises are similar. I mean, people who have done exercises and conversations around race will be like, oh, yeah, we're doing this one now. That's not new. What's new is the questions that come after and the way that we talk about it and think about it in the container that we hold it in.
Aisha, what about you? Have you seen any generational differences? You've watched it 5 times.
So we haven't, and it just as you were talking, you asked that question, Joanne, I was thinking that it would be great to do it with youth, but we haven't. So the generational difference would be from, you know, my generation, Gen Xer, to boomers. So it's not an across the board, it's very individual. I have some folks in their 70s and 80s who are totally on board, get it, no problem, and others who are really have problems even with just the Black Lives Matter. We have it in our order of service every week, and people are complaining, like, well, why that? Why not climate action, and why not this and that? And so there's definitely a range, and I haven't found, at least here, the ability to pigeonhole a generation. I do want to say, and I think I could share this because we share a story, not a name. The difficulty I had with Beloved Conversations was with other, well, white ministers. And that's been hard. Like, I took this as a professional religious educator with other religious educators and ministers before Fall Conference, and I was surprised at how hard it was for me, being a person of color in the room. And it was the microaggression exercise, Julika, interestingly enough, where a white person, minister, said, now the whole point of the exercise, and it's so I can describe the exercise, it's a person standing in the middle and a group of people walking around shouting microaggression. So actually, I think it was the one where it was a fair-looking Mexican person, and you say things like, oh, you don't look Mexican, like, oh, whatever it, you know, whatever the, and it's like 5 people walking around saying it, and it's really powerful and upsetting. And so the whole point is to understand what microaggressions are. And after this exercise, this person gets up and says, well, we have to really, you know, make sure we keep in mind the feelings of the aggressor. And my whole body, I was sitting next to a friend of mine, another minister, and I said to her, I can't not say something to that, because it felt like such an assault. And I'm like, that is not the point of this exercise. And the problem that I'm finding in UU circles is, and I'm going to now not as much at East Shore, and it's when I'm in professional circles, and it's disappointing when it's from white clergy, is this notion that feelings of other white people supersede the work. And it's like we're so focused on protecting people's feelings. And Gail Forsyth Vail, my colleague at the UUA, made a phenomenal point. Her daughter, who's an attorney, wrote a whole paper on why hate crime legislation is problematic. Because as soon as someone feels threatened, that's why George Zimmerman got away with what he did. He only had to feel something. He had to feel threatened by Trayvon Martin. And so as soon as we legislate feelings, and we do that, and I've seen, when I forgive it when it's laity. But when you've gone through seminary and you have been ordained a UU minister and you come out with, and the cluelessness is painful in a different way. And so for me, that's when I felt, and I didn't know what to, there's nothing, I mean, you know, I did say something, and it wasn't until another white person said a different version of what I said that this minister finally heard me, and didn't hear me, heard that person, heard what I was trying to say. So it was painful.
Well, you know, I wonder if there's not a generational issue within how seminary education is working, and that's
well for sure that.
Because so at Meadville, you know, which our flagship UU seminary, it was only 2 years ago that we created an allied white student group for folks, you know, for seminarians to do work on their white identity, and even more recently, and so. Only in the past 2 years are people like, I mean, not everyone is a member, but people know that we're there and we're raising these questions. Yeah, it would be great to bring in Robin D'Angelo and any number of other folks too. And then I lost my thread, so I'm going to give it up. But yeah, I think the new breed of seminarian is coming in with an awareness on this that maybe didn't exist before. I don't know. I hate to speak.
Well, and I'm really curious how looking at things through systems theory, which I totally do, is affecting this? I mean, because Aisha, I'm hearing you, and I'm going, okay, like most basic part of systems theory, anyone who's had any education in systems theory is you have to be responsible for your own feelings, and it is over-serving if you try to become responsible for someone else's feelings. You know, like get to the point, get to the, you know, I'm with you. That seems a bizarre barrier.
And I would also add that, and Isha, I'm sorry that happened, and I'm sorry that these things continue to happen, but the other thing that I think is true is that this is where we really are as a group of institutions and as a movement. The UU movement is in this space where there's a lot of white folks that are still wanting to take care of their feelings and their process. And if we don't make room for that to be said, then we're not going to move forward to the next piece and to the systems training, to the systemic understanding of how these things play out. So I think it's about creating containers where those of us who are people of color have a space where we can be nourished and be able to come back to where our movement is, because it is where it is, and we need to engage it and let it come out rather than not. Does that make sense?
It does to me, and Aisha, I'm afraid this is going to come out horribly wrong, because that sounds incredibly awful and painful to have seen that exercise and then hear that reflection. And as somebody who was around for those Jubilee trainings and those things that people are still feeling wounded by, that is what white people are still feeling wounded by 20 years later. That they're,
I know, it's
feeling
20 years.
More heard, right? And they're still backlashing from it. And so...
Yes.
And
that's the white fragility problem that we have.
Exactly.
We have a white fragility problem, but we need to engage it. And it's not that it's okay that happened, Aisha, but that we need to let it happen so that it stops happening, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
But I want to push back on that, because I don't know if that's – so I hear that. I hear you. And I'm – you know, I'm – so what I learned from going – you know, I went to a four-hour workshop with Robin DiAngelo, and here's how she actually wrote a great article that caused a lot of controversy when I put it on my Facebook page, White Women's Tears and the Men Who Love Them. And here's what's interesting about that. And she says – and she actually talked about it in her workshop, and she said – when she does a workshop, she begins by saying, if you are a white person and you feel emotional and you're about to cry when we're talking about race, please leave the room. Collect yourself and then come back, because this is not about you. So it was the first time – she is not a UU. It was the first time – what was helpful about that was she acknowledged you're going to have feelings. She's not telling it – she's not policing feelings. She's not telling anyone not to feel what you need to feel. What she's acknowledging and naming and reacting to is saying white privilege always takes precedent over everything else, and that has been our system and our world. And so when she says, look, cry, feel what you need to feel, but leave the room. If you find yourself, you're about, she said, please leave the room, collect yourself, and come back, because it is not the responsibility of the people of color in this room to make you feel better about what they've gone through. And she begins her workshop, just to say, I've never seen this before either. She's a white person, Robin, and she says, the people of color in the room, I'm inviting you to challenge me and to hold me accountable. The white people in the room do not have that invitation. And it's a powerful beginning. And it's a way to, she frames it, she's probably one of the best facilitators on race I've ever seen. Because she is strong and she holds people accountable, and it is uncomfortable. And she said, if you're watching me and you're not uncomfortable, I'm not doing what I'm supposed to. So I think maybe because, you know, ministers come from a place where you do have to, you know, give, you know, account for people's feelings or be there for people's feelings in a different way. But I think when talking about race, I feel like we need to do it differently, or else white privilege will always supersede even discussions about race if we're always making space for. I've seen it happen where the whole energy in the room just gets sucked out because a white woman is crying. I mean, I've not seen a white man do it, but yeah. Anyway,
I understand what you're saying, Aisha, and I agree with you to a certain point. But I think that what you're describing is 200 and 300 level type conversations. If I'm going to invite a white person into a conversation about race, and this is the first time that they're actually going to take some risks, then I do want them to talk about their feelings. And if I, as a person of color, am going to be triggered by the fact that their feelings are about their white privilege, then maybe I, as a person of color, also need to make sure that I am in a stable place. Because I personally think that, yes, I completely agree with you that white fragility takes us off the rails, but if we don't address it, how can we get past it? I think that we have to have different levels of conversations for people who have been in this conversation more or less. Don't you?
Yes, and so I think we're talking about two different things. People need to have feelings, and at some point, and maybe you're right, maybe the issue is 200 or 300 level conversations. And so the reason why I think I was so, reacted the way I did with a white minister saying this, because I thought we were having a 200 or 300 conversation. It was a very 100 level response. But but yes, what Robin does is 200 or 300. It is not, if for the person, I would say Beloved Conversations is a great starting point, and then going to something. So we're not, I don't think we're disagreeing. I think it's where we are.
You're right. Yeah, I think you're right.
Can we unpack this a little more about the crying thing? Because I've been confused about this. Like, so as a white person, if I go to a training, I can't sit there and quietly let tears run down my face?
I think it depends on what you're talking about. If you're there to talk about feelings and that's the setting, go ahead. This is an example. We're talking about a conversation on racial identity, seeing the water, understanding whiteness in daily life. And so her whole point is she's lifting up white privilege and what that even means and what it looks like. She had slides and everything. What she's saying is when you're and she's done also work on she worked for the city of Seattle and in institutions. And so if you're there to talk about race and you're feeling emotional, she just asks people to leave the room, because what ends up happening is everyone now is comforting that person. And now it's not about anymore what you're talking about, or even if let's say you're talking about the injustices of slavery, and a white person bursts into tears because they're so overwhelmed, they just saw 12 years of slave or something. Well, now the whole conversation turns into that person's white feeling, that white person's feelings instead of.
Person's white feelings is good. Yeah.
So it's the response. It's letting those tears get centered. That is the issue. Not
well,
so much.
It's not centering whiteness, right?
Right, and I think that the example that Aisha that you were bringing is we're talking about microaggressions, and then a person talks about the aggressor, which is challenging, because right. In that moment, I think the focus is what is the impact of microaggressions on a person of color. So that was a moment of shifting, using privilege. Right. And if I had facilitated that conversation, I probably would have said, let's take a moment to notice how this question changes the focus, and that's part of what we're trying to work on. But I do want those things said, even though they're painful and annoying and they bring the conversation back down to the 100 level, because I feel like 100 level comments have not been permitted in previous ways of having these conversations, and that's where all the wounding comes from. You can't say that, you're so stupid, don't you see your privilege? There goes another white person that's not going to be an ally. For me, that's what I think. I don't know.
Well, and I would assume that one of the challenges with this is that you have both the personal and the objective going on at the same time. If you had medical students who were learning, who were autopsying a body, and one of the students was throwing up, okay, that there is a personal issue there of, gee, maybe you shouldn't be a doctor or whatever, but it's also, should the entire class stop what they're doing?
Right, no.
One person, I mean, and both are important.
Perfect yeah. analogy.
But the purpose yeah, is yeah, yeah. completely Great different. Analogy. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm behind that.
So that makes me wonder, I have heard rumors that Mark is now working on faith formation for people of color, because what I hear in Aisha's story and I hear over and over is it always centers back. Leslie Mack brought this up last week of how, when white people talk about our first experience of racism, it's about us and how hard it was for us. And So when, and it's sort of like, when does it get to be about centering the people of color? So I've heard that Mark is working on a program. Do you know anything about that, Julika? Is that part of Beloved Conversations, or is that a completely different thing?
I have heard that Mark is working on a couple of projects, and he's keeping them secret, and he won't tell me, and it's driving me nuts. I don't know.
Workshop.
I know what you know, Meg, because that paper that he shared with us in that class that we were in together is part of that work. But that's I know as much as you do right now, actually, I think. Okay. And I'm very excited.
And so necessary.
I know that's he has a lot
public,
of
non-public. That's the most public, non-public document I've ever heard. I've read
right.
The you're referring to, too. Everyone's read it, but no one's allowed to talk about it. I love that.
I know. It's so funny.
One of the things I would encourage folks who listen to this to do, if you have even if three people of color in your congregation, encourage them to create a people of color affinity group, because we did at East Shore as a result. After caucusing and Beloved Conversations, now the first one, Rhonda couldn't caucus with anyone because it was all white people. The second one I was in, and we had a group, and it felt so good. She called me up, said, we're doing this once a month. So we've been meeting once a month, and it's just been transformational. And I go. I mean, I talked to a minister colleague of color of mine, and she said, you know, the group in my church, I don't go. I said, oh, no, I go. I really feel, you know, I'm not going to stop being human because I'm a religious professional. I go. I love it. And so that's been transformational and really important.
Well, we're coming to the close of our hour. Julika, anything we didn't ask you that you were all excited to tell us that you want to say before the hour's up? Are you taking applications?
We don't take applications. If you're interested in doing it, just go online, meadville.edu/beloved. And all of our contact information is there, but call me. Give me a call or send me an email, and I'm happy to talk to you. There are some congregations that are not in a place where they are ready to do this work, but that's a minority, and that's usually because they're in ministerial transition or have had a very recent crisis or something like that. But otherwise, I'm very excited to bring this work and would love to hear from more people.
Great. Well, thank you. Thanks for the work. Thanks for that offer. We'll put that link on the Facebook page for you. Next week, we're going to have Bill Schultz and John Cresswell coming to talk about a movie that Ken Burns is making about the Sharps, Martha and Wadesel Sharp, Unitarians who rescued many, many Jewish folks during the Holocaust, and about moral courage. So join us for that. I'm excited to say we actually were live today. Our small but loyal band of live viewers got to see this when it happened. So hopefully whatever that was, that little
shout out to Lori Stone Sertoski for making it happen.
Hats off to Lori Stone Sertoski, who, by the way, has been working with Bob to make that happen for weeks. We don't know what was wrong. We hope and pray it's over now. That little blip. But anyway, great to be with you all. See you next week.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.